Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we're going through the Constitution. We've wrapped up the 12th Amendment, or at least we were still having a conversation regarding that. And, you know, let me just say this. I love tenacity. I love it when you have a tenacious dog that just won't give up a bone. And not that I'm calling Paul Venable a dog, but I, you know, he's very tenacious in you know, trying to understand something, and he's starting to chew on something and so forth. So obviously I have sent him the links that I was talking about so he could kind of look at the process. And welcome back, Paul. And so this is where I remind Paul that he might be on mute. And
thank you for the reminder. I said thank you, and now I remember that I'm now off mute.
Excuse me. So okay. You bet. So one of the things that Paul noted, and I go, you know what, even before we have this conversation, we really need to turn the microphone or, you know, get the show started. So because I didn't want to have this conversation and then say, you know what, the listener needed to hear this. Now, we know that politics, you know, there's a lot of things in play when it comes to politics, and compromise is one of those things. And as we were looking, and as I told you yesterday, that, you know, as things started going down the, you know, as they launched this ship called the Constitution and this great republic on it, it didn't take long for deviations and, or I'm going to use the word compromise, to start appearing. And so, and this is where we started realizing that, you know, as Washington warned us of good intentions, mm-hmm. and how we should never allow compromise based on good intentions to ever, you know, compromise the Constitution, because that's how governments, good governments, are destroyed.
Right.
And we read, Paul, you and I read the cod fishery bounties, and mm-hmm. and Madison was very clear. You start making these compromises in allowing us to use the public treasury to do these bounties, then next thing you know, what? They were going to start doing what with the treasury?
Man, he was prophetic, G.R. They were going to start doing things with schools.
Schools, education, exactly, right, health care. I mean, he didn't put health care, but he went as drastic as basically preaching to the children.
Right.
You know, they were. I could just imagine how everybody was, yes, no, we're not going to do that. And
wow.
I think, so my point is that the framers were kind of warning us of all of this. And so Paul made this note, and I just want to get everybody, you know, so we can get moving here. I made this note that Washington was elected unanimously because he was looking at the information I sent him, how the Electoral College selected Washington unanimously twice. And then I pointed out, now if you look, Monroe was voted or elected almost unanimously, minus one cast vote. In other words, it wasn't the vote cast against him. It was a vote not cast. Mm. In other words, it wasn't Monroe getting all of the votes and one vote went to somebody else. That person from New Hampshire, the elector from New Hampshire, chose not to vote for Monroe and allowed his vote to just linger uncast. So that it was not unanimous. It was it wasn't a vote for somebody else, but there, you know, so in other words, it was overwhelmingly, you know, a goose egg to everybody, but it was this little message that this elector wanted to make sure that Monroe was not Washington.
Huh. So, but that leads to a question.
That led to what the question, what was the year that happened?
It was 1820.
And so if you were looking at the year before that, in 1816, when Monroe was originally elected, what was the percentages?
Hang on just a minute. I had that.
Yeah, I get it. And because this is, I knew you're going to have to do a little research, but this is worth it because, folks, 9 times out of 10, when we see something happening, there's usually a cause and effect.
Okay. In 1816, Monroe won by 84%. He got 183 votes to 34.
34. Right? Okay. So, in other words, what happened in 1820 that caused Monroe to get all of those votes? Well, what happened historically that needed Monroe's help to allow happen? What happened in 1820 that's significant?
Well, in 1820 was the Missouri Compromise.
Uh-huh. And the Missouri Compromise happened when? What's the date of the Missouri Compromise?
Hang on. Let me...
Okay. So we need to do a little Googling here, folks.
Okay.
Right? And let me see here. The Missouri Compromise of 1820.
Missouri Compromise date definition. Let me see.
Because we know the election of 1820 was at the end of the year.
Correct.
Okay. So what day did the Missouri Compromise occur?
I am searching for that.
Okay, so it was proposed in 1819.
Uh-huh.
It was March 6th of 1820.
Okay.
So in other words, it was basically a half a year before the election. Monroe had a choice. He could have vetoed this bill, folks.
He could have vetoed the bill from the Missouri Compromise.
Yes.
Now, so...
No. So let's look at it this way. All what right. would happen if Monroe vetoed the bill and Congress had enough support that they could have overrid his veto?
Well, Monroe probably would not have won the next election.
Or right? at least he would not. Well, it would have been a much tougher election.
It would have been a tougher election. So
correct.
But, you know, we discussed the Missouri Compromise.
We do a lot because it is that important. Yeah, go ahead.
And so he could have. It might have been, G.R., the constitutional position to veto the Missouri Compromise. Right? Might have been.
Absolutely, it would have been. Absolutely, it would have been. But you know, when you're looking at, you just won with 80-some percent. You've done 4 years in office. And what really caused this getting over this leap of becoming unanimously selected by the electors?
It's surprising. I would almost guess that the Missouri Compromise was so contentious it could have split the union. That's one guess. That the compromise was actually what it was, a compromise. And the division was so deep that had it not been for the compromise, it could have been really difficult. Now, I'm just guessing.
No, you're absolutely right. So uh-huh. I don't think that the Missouri Compromise at all would have been able to overpower the Monroe veto.
Okay.
So I honestly think that there had to be some players because let me ask you this. Do you know what states you didn't carry in your election 4 years ago? If you're the president of the United States and you knew what the outcome was, you got 84%. So you kind of know where you didn't get it.
Right.
I'll bet you anything. He was presented with the opportunity of saying, you know what? We're going to make sure you get, you know, all of the votes to get you reelected if you actually vote for this, because they knew they were desperate to get Missouri as a slave state. Remember, we talked about why Missouri became a slave state. It had nothing to do with the desire of the people of Missouri. It had everything to do with the few investors that basically were, you know, were heavily invested in having slavery in Missouri.
Right. So, but I'm looking back, and what the Electoral College says is that everybody, okay, so here we've got the Missouri Compromise, and everybody voted for Monroe. It's like, okay, this is unconstitutional, but it's like everyone stood back and took a deep breath. Oh, we got past that one. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Because yeah. Because for everyone to do it, this means that the states that opposed slavery had to vote for him also. Right? It means that everyone on both sides of the question were united, you know, with the exception of the one vote, this would have been unanimous, were united for James Monroe. So it, in a sense, GR, it doesn't quite make sense to me.
Okay, so Monroe carried 16 out of the 19 states. In other words, he didn't get three states. I honestly believe that even though it may have been contentious that he could have vetoed it and it would have died, I believe that there was some trappings to say, we're going to help you with your reelection. They knew it was a So, in 1822, when Congress came to him, and basically this was his last year, Congress came to him when he didn't even have to work for a reelection. They thought for sure he would pass the Department of Transportation bill or that bonus bill that they did. And he vetoed it. He did the right thing. But in 1820, when he knew he had to get reelected, see, the Democratic Party, and even though there were the people of the states, the abolition movement of the people, were moving in one direction, that doesn't mean that the states were that way. Where did the Democratic Party arise? Where did the gag rule arise from regarding stopping the abolition movement in the Senate? That all arose from New York and the North. Van Buren, a New York representative, was the one that, as the leader of the Democratic Party, he basically sanctioned and blessed the gag rule to stop petitions for the abolition movement. So, I mean, we're diving into a lot of history here, but I'm just telling you that I believe that there was a benefit in the unanimous selection of Monroe because of the Missouri Compromise. And so I'm only guessing, but yes, when you look at, you know, things aren't really separate. That wasn't really separate from something. I mean, we're talking about the nature of politics where compromise is the name of the game. I mean, read Aristotle's book, Politics, because politics is in everything. It's in marriage. Everybody that's been married or is married understands the struggles of compromise.
Correct.
You know, like, I love this, you know, the rules of engagement, one of the very first shows, I think it was the pilot show of the rules of engagement. You know, Jeff, this character, was explaining to Adam, another character who was engaged to get married, you know, the whole point of compromise in a marriage. And he says, you know, when he and his Audrey wanted to get married, he said, you know, he wanted a dog, she didn't want a dog, or she wanted a cat. And he goes, so we compromised. We got a cat. And then he goes on to all of these other things. And, you know, each time he, you know, goes, I wanted this, she wanted that. And he goes, what did we get? And Adams quickly learned that they always got what Audrey wanted, not what he wanted. And he goes, oh, okay, so now you understand the art of compromise.
So, yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so that was... But it was those 1820 was a pivotal year.
It was.
Because the Monroe Compromise, not the Monroe, the Missouri Compromise happened, and James Monroe had a nearly unanimous vote in the Electoral College.
Yes.
Those two could not have been separate.
Correct. Correct. So, in other words, he had, you know, and who are the electors and who are the representatives? Back in those days, it was pretty heir apparent, folks, that we the people were pretty ignorant. Most of us couldn't read. We weren't educated. Most of us, you know, basically relied heavily upon these really honorable men who were serving us. Do you think that gave them some license and latitude to think, yeah, well, maybe we can take advantage of this? In 1821, a group of men went to James Madison begging him to release his notes on the Constitutional Convention. Why? Because they were seeing things that weren't jiving with what they understood the Constitution to mean. Mm-hmm. And they asked him, please let us know, because we want to understand how you, the framers, during that Constitutional Convention, you know, described what these things in the Constitution mean. And Madison came back to him and said, look, it doesn't matter what we thought. The only thing that matters is what the states understood that Constitution to mean at the time of ratification. So basically, he pointed them to go read the ratification debates.
So here's my question. I knew you were going there. So did they read the ratification bit?
Because I don't know. I don't think so. Because the War of 1812, they burnt up, you know, the Library of Congress. You know, the nation was still kind of, you know, recovering. How long does it take to, you know, to if a person loses their home and they have no insurance?
Years.
Their house burns down. Well, you know, right. What does it take for you to overcome? You didn't have insurance. You didn't have all these safeguards of duplications. You didn't have some high availability, redundant computing system that was, you know, stretched all the way around the world so that, you know, regardless of how many nodes you took down, you were able to replicate your data so that you could be back up and running. They didn't have that. There was no high availability back then. They had it all done and it was burnt. Now, right. The interesting thing is the state houses weren't burnt. Only Congress was. So they had to reduplicate these ratification debates, which is really was a part of the Eliot Project. That's why when you look at Congress and the ratification debates as a part of the record of Congress, they came in as the Eliot Papers.
Right. In which they went through the archives of the states, correct?
Correct. And so the states produced what they thought was relevant of probably what they sent before. They didn't send their full records. This is why the University of Wisconsin went on this project of the documentation history of the ratification of the Constitution, the DHRC, which is where you have 18, I think it's 18 volumes, or there's a whole bunch.
Wow.
It's $2,000, and I've said this before, anybody out there that wants to, you know, give me a Christmas gift, a birthday gift, as a matter of fact, Friday's my birthday.
Well, happy birthday, Pierre.
It's mine and the rest of the Marine Corps' birthday. You know, I recognize the Marine Corps birthday, right? The whole world recognizes the Marine Corps birthday.
Wow, okay.
So, anyway, actually, it's not this Friday. It's the following Friday, the 10th.
Your birthday and the Marine Corps' birthday.
Correct, yeah.
That's awesome. Well, that's good to know.
Anyway, no, well, actually, my personal birthday is a different time of the year. I'm just saying that I always recognize, every Marine recognizes the Marine Corps birthday.
Or birthday.
Yeah.
Okay.
I celebrate that. I don't celebrate my own birthday. I celebrate the Marine Corps birthday.
Okay. This is
all right.
An insight that I would not have guessed at, GR, is just there's always something going on.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, you'll notice on Wikipedia that they're already spinning the information one way because they're claiming that Monroe was a part of the Democratic Republican Party nomination. That wasn't the case. There wasn't a party nomination back then, and it wasn't the Democratic Republican Party. It was the Republican Party, as Madison pointed out.
Hey, there is a footnote here on James Monroe in 1820. Okay. On the Wikipedia page says there was a dispute as to whether Missouri's electoral votes in 1820 were valid due to the timing of its assumption of statehood. The figures listed include those votes. So I had your document and I had the Wikipedia thing open as well, and I just thought that was interesting.
Okay, so I have Missouri becoming a state August 10th, 1821.
Interesting.
Right.
Okay.
But it doesn't matter. The one vote that he didn't get was from New Hampshire.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
But I'm just telling you that there was the people with affluence that actually was throwing money around, they wanted to make sure that slavery was going to endure the evolution of our government going to liberty, or actually, you know, because folks, I've told you the Missouri Compromise only proved that the Constitution was eradicating slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had to come up with a way to undermine the Constitution. And Monroe was unfortunately duped into becoming a part of that, you know, unsavory part of history.
Yeah.
He also created the Monroe Doctrine. I mean, he was a great president, but mm-hmm. Is what he did unforgivable? I would say to every black person in America, absolutely. There was alive, and their forefathers were a part of all of that. Their history was there, absolutely.
Mm.
As a nation, I mean, he did some really big things. But, you know, I can understand why some people just – but I also understand the importance of forgiveness,
mm-hmm.
right? Because who bears the greater sin? The person that can't forgive or the person that committed the sin?
Sure. Okay. Understood.
All right. Well, so we've killed the whole first half hour. And so because what we're going to do, folks, I actually have – a hard recording of the 14th Amendment. So we got two 13th Amendments to do. And so what we may end up doing is we may end up having to split the 13th Amendments, because in my next show tomorrow, my next episode, will be airing the first of the two shows that I did with Angeline Marie. Angeline Marie broadcasts out of, she's on like three different broadcast podcasts, you know, shows. And she will cover that, and we will actually have her information up on Reclaiming the Republic today or by tomorrow, hopefully. I'm really bad at getting that stuff up there. But we will be reading through the 14th Amendment, and she's going to kind of explain, you know, where she is, because she's a part of, I think, the center for thought of how things are drifting towards the sovereign citizen movement. Because they make a great case that everybody looks at what the federal government's doing. It's not in line with the Constitution, and clearly it's either legitimate or it's illegitimate, and the sovereign citizens are saying that's all legitimate. In other words, they're killing people and they're, you know, subjugating people legitimately, and I actually, you know, go through the process of going through the 14th Amendment to prove that it is not legitimate.
But what's not legitimate?
What they're doing. All of these powers that they've assumed, these corporations, all of this stuff, it's a weaving of webbery that is so sophisticated that it seems all legitimate, but none of it is legitimate. The debt is not legitimate. The treaties, our involvement in globalism, not legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is why it is important that we start taking a stand. We use First Amendment petitions, blah, blah, blah. We'll be right back because we're going into break right now. So anyway, I appreciate, you know, the derailment or the conversation that stemmed from the 12th Amendment. But it's time to hit the 13th Amendment. So that's what we're going to do. And so when we come back, we're going to go with the first 13th Amendment that was ratified in 1812. We'll be right back after this.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
All right, folks, so we're back. And before we get into the first 13th Amendment, if you're looking at the 1820 election, Paul, on Wikipedia, I think the real thing is the whole point of the Federalist Party. I think those who were part of the Federalist Party really were the ones that probably said, "Hey, we won't even form a candidate to go against you."
Okay,
which is one of the reasons why, you know, it was really just them. There was nobody that actually competed against them, where you can actually see where Monroe was basically competing against somebody else. You know, they actually had a different person and a different group of electors out there. So anyway, so the system was really, at that point in time, very dependent on the Electoral College, unlike today. So anyway, let's dive into what we call the first 13th Amendment.
Okay, looks like we've got three of them here.
Yes. So the first one was proposed in 1810, and it was ratified, not even questionably, it was ratified, as it states right here, ratified in 1812.
Okay.
So what is it?
Here we go.
Go ahead.
If any citizen of the United States shall accept, claim, receive, or retain any title of nobility or honor, or shall, without the consent of Congress, accept and retain any present, pension, office, or emolument of any kind whatever from any emperor, king, prince, or foreign power, such person shall cease to be a citizen of the United States and shall be incapable of holding any office of trust or profit under them or either of them.
Okay, so what is a title of nobility or honor? Or, here's the other thing that I think is really important, an emolument.
So, this is really a hot button. You know, I would think a title of nobility or honor, first of all, these were not part of the United States, the American lexicon, okay? But in monarchical countries, you know, you had titles of nobility, like knight, count, duke, prince, etc.
You know, sheriff. Hold on here. A sheriff was a title of nobility, as a position of nobility. You were not compensated in England, until you got to a certain point.
All right.
It was a position of honor, and so before it, you know, it first started as a position of honor, and then it grew into something greater. Compensation, okay. All of that, right? So, okay, go ahead.
So, and another one, I'll bring this up because it's going to come up, is a term of squire or esquire.
Correct.
So leads to a couple questions, GR.
No,
go ahead. Let's...
No. Ask the questions. Now's the time.
Okay. So, you know, you and I are going through the ratification debates.
Uh-huh.
And many of the people who were in these debates, as well as many of the framers, were attorneys. They were lawyers.
Right.
Okay.
They were common law lawyers.
Right.
Correct. Uh-huh.
Okay. Yep. And so when we look at this thing called, you know, the original 13th Amendment, we've got to know why would lawyers do something like this, and what drove it?
Well, so if you look at how the end of the 18th century was going, there was a huge division in America between Anglophiles and Francophiles. And, you know, who ended up winning the presidency at the beginning of the 19th century? In other words, in 1800, what was the prevailing winning, you know, group? Because going into the 19th century, the Anglophiles, you know, were basically occupying government.
Sure.
Okay, so that means the Federalists were occupying government. The Federalists were then challenged by the Francophiles, who
were the Francophiles were the anti-Federalists?
They were the Republicans. Thomas Jefferson was considered a Francophile or an anti-Anglophile.
Okay.
Right. So now we see that there was a shift in the 1800s that, you know, started slowly weeding away the Francophiles. So there was obviously a shift in common law in America going away from the British common law because the Constitution demanded it, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is why I tell you, somebody should have sat down and wrote the commentaries of common law under our Constitution, like Blackstone did regarding his commentaries of common law in England under the monarch.
Okay.
This would have really helped clear things up and separate our legal system away from the paradigm of a magistrate and the doctrine of magistrates.
Okay.
So that didn't happen. So as we started moving forward, what they did do was they created this amendment. Mm-hmm. This amendment, because they realized that the legal system of the monarch of the Anglo world, or I should say the British monarchy, the empire that was kind of stretched across the world, basically putting its legal system everywhere, they said, we're not going to have any part of that. Where they actually have this esquire, a title of nobility.
Okay.
And so this amendment was a line in the sand. Again, it was proposed in 1810.
Right.
While Jefferson's administration went into its third term under Madison.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Madison, actually, because he wasn't necessarily a lawyer like Jefferson, maybe mm-hmm. he became a champion of this. I really need to do all the due diligence and become everything 13th Amendment, but I think if I do that, it just takes me away from doing a lot of other things. But okay. I'm giving you my analysis as I look at this, and I say, why did this happen under Madison's term, halfway through his first term? Mm-hmm. Well, I think Madison was starting to realize how the legal system itself was being used to undermine our system and our laws. As a matter of fact, we had, you know, he saw that it was probably just nothing but a sea of lawyers, and he wanted to make sure that they would not be lawyers that would be loyal to the British crown or to the bar, the British, what is it,
accreditation?
No, it's not accreditation. Look up the bar. The A is accreditory or something like that. It's okay. Not accreditation. It's an accreditee, or anyway, registry. And so the R stands for registry. So in other words, these are the people serving the crown. The American bar is the American legal service system, American legal system serving the British registry, the British crown.
British accredited registry.
Accredited, not accreditation. Okay. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Is it accredited? Okay.
Wait. Hang on a minute. I'm looking. Sorry. My. Sorry. My source for that was at a glance when I looked at it, it came from Snopes. I need to get a different.
Yeah. So background. If you look up the definition of the founding of the the bar or the American bar, I think you'll find that the American bar was founded in 1870 something, 1871, and mm-hmm. That's when they came out of the closet. I talked about this on my show once, that if you look at the American bar is when all of these the loyal British lawyers out there actually, came out of the closet and said, we're going to support this legal system that is a part of Britain and not the legal system that is the common law under our Constitution. Mm. Where the magistrate actually is retained. Who's the magistrate under the bar? The judges. Mm-hmm. Who is the magistrate under common law, under the Constitution? The magistrate is the Constitution, and it's constrained by the people. Or
the
vice versa.
Is the Constitution?
Yes. Yes. I mean, the bar.
The Constitution is the law.
Well, correct. The bar actually points to a magistrate to interpret or to decide. Ah. So, in other words, whatever the magistrate utters becomes law.
So, okay. So, we've got this original Article 13. We've got here in your document says contested article. But it's not in our current constitutions. Boy, things would certainly be different if it were.
Absolutely, it would, because no state would have anybody that's a part of the American bar serving in the, and we would actually have, and we would still to this day have common law courts where we would not have these legal courts that just make money because your marriage didn't work out, or make money because you thought you had hurried to get to work today.
Mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, it starts up by saying, if any citizen of the United States shall accept, claim, receive, retain. So you asked a question about emoluments.
Yes, what right? is an emolument?
Let me give you. An emolument is maybe a benefit. A financial benefit, a gift.
It's a benefit that may not be actually in the terms of cash, but it is a benefit that could be translated into some form of compensation.
Okay, so let me give you, if we have, for example, members of Congress who are receiving some kind of financial benefit from foreign entities, I would consider that an emolument.
Yes.
And in fact,
hold on, let's actually look at an actual emolument that goes to the former presidents of the United States.
Okay.
Do they not have a secret security detail that protects them and their family?
Well, sure.
Is that a financial benefit? No, they don't get paid. But whatever it is, whatever's necessary, we give them that emolument.
Well, in addition to a retirement pay.
Well, that's a different. But I'm just saying. So
okay.
Yeah. So in the Constitution, there is no emolument offered to a president. Former president, when he steps down, he becomes a citizen. No benefits, nothing, no more emoluments. So what happened is Congress actually started offering emoluments to the president, like retiree pay, other benefits and so forth. So in other words, they have this huge emolument package that goes to a former president. So let me ask you, when you look at the definition of impeachment, what is an impeachment? Is it a judgment of crime? No. Impeachment is a removal of emoluments.
Okay.
A removal from office and emoluments. And so if you're not in office, Well, but you're receiving emoluments. Can you still be impeached? Absolutely.
Sure. So that's interesting because, you know, because I got to tell you a little strange thing I discovered. I don't know what presidents, you know, we talked about this emolument, but, you know, they didn't start by getting retirements either, right? I'll tell you what I know. Thomas Jefferson left the presidency and requested a loan from a bank, okay?
Uh-huh.
He requested a help from Abraham Bedford Venable.
Uh-huh.
And it's in the National Archives. They exchanged a written conversation which he thanked Abraham Venable for assisting him in getting his loan when he left office, because he didn't leave office a rich man.
No. Okay. And he had to pay to move all of his stuff that he acquired as president back to Monticello.
Right. And by the way, I brought that up because I haven't exactly verified it, but I believe I'm related to this Abraham Venable.
Oh, okay. Awesome. Okay? Congratulations.
And so that kind of thing stood out to me. That's how I know that. That's one of the reasons I know that, you know, the founders didn't do this to get rich.
No.
And so I just looked something up and I said, when did the president start receiving a pension? And right. It looks to me. Well, ex-president did not receive pensions or retirement benefits. 1912, industrious Andrew Carnegie had offered to fund an annual pension for ex-presidents.
Yes.
Okay.
So, in other words, in response to the private sector doing these things, they said, you know what, we need to be doing this for ourselves. And this is when government assumed this. There's never been an amendment to the Constitution to allow retirement pay or any benefits to be given and afforded to our former public servants.
Right. In fact, so what happened, they passed something called the Former Presidents Act, which Dwight Eisenhower is the first president to fall under these provisions. That's recent. That's within my lifetime.
Yeah, and oh boy, Dwight Eisenhower, the guy that told us, keep an eye on this military-industrial complex.
Right.
So, okay. All right. So, but I think we've kind of put this to bed. The 13th Amendment that got ratified never was unratified. That's what we need to kind of talk about, because
so where is it?
So you can find this evidence that the 13th Amendment was still in existence in the 1870s in the compiled laws of Wyoming, where Wyoming was becoming a state. They basically reached out and grabbed all of the amendments. And I kind of point this out in my next show, how the 14th Amendment was not included in this compiling in, I think, 1871 or 1870, whatever.
It's actually 1876, because I've got it open in front of me.
Oh, okay, so that's fine. In other words, in Wyoming, they still didn't know if that 14th Amendment was actually ratified or not yet, because there were states that were contending at that point that they actually rejected it. And so, you know, as all of these people are chattering back in those days when they, you know, it's not like we had the wire where we could actually, you know, listen to everybody and go and actually present the case nationwide. It took a long time to finally settle in. Oh, well, you can't take those things back, even though you thought you did. That doesn't mean Congress is actually changing your position on it. The amendment doesn't allow you to do that.
Well, the other point to make here is, at this time, Wyoming was a territory. They wanted to have a compilation of the laws so that when they became a state, and this was over 60 years later.
Yeah. Okay. Right. And so the whole point, it has nothing to do with the 14th Amendment, has everything to do with the 13th Amendment. 60 years later, it had been galvanized into the law. This is also prior to the founding of the America, or actually I think if you look, the founding of the American Bar just happens. So in other words, the founding of the American Bar occurred, and now all of a sudden they realize they have an enemy that they have to dispatch. Mm-hmm. In other words, they have to secretly dispose of the 13th Amendment because it creates a direct conflict. Even though most people don't think and even know about the nobility amendment, they know they need to get rid of it because eventually it may come into question, and you want to have, as clean of a domicile as you possibly can as you start setting up your ability to roost and rule. And so as the Bar Association, the American Bar Association, was, starting to actually spread and take more and more control over our legal system and over our political system.
I found it. August 21, 1878. That's a year after, a couple years after I see this in the...
Oh, is that, that's when they founded the American Bar Association?
I just looked it up.
Oh, okay.
On the ABA webpage.
Yeah, so that's fine. Okay. I can tell you that members or people that were in bed with the Bar Association in America didn't just happen in 1878. In other words, we've had lawyers working and growing this. And I honestly think this is probably where the Illuminati went. Most people think the Illuminati probably went into the back rooms of the Freemasons. And I think possibly Freemasonry was a vehicle here. But I believe that the American Bar Association was, really that extra layer behind that Illuminati, where they were moving us forward and moving us down that path. So anyway, what's really important, folks, is the fact that we actually have a 13th Amendment that was ratified and was never unratified. Does that make sense?
Makes sense.
Okay. So what we now have is a second 13th Amendment that comes along, which actually would have been and was recorded in the compiled laws of Wyoming, the 14th Amendment, which actually is not the one that's in there, but this would have been the 14th Amendment, not the 13th Amendment, and it was presented or proposed in 1861, signed by a very aggressive president, who presidents never sign amendments. But
yeah,
Lincoln actually signed this amendment, basically putting his seal of approval on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's go ahead and read this 13th Amendment so we can kind of get this, because we're 5.5 minutes left here.
Okay. It says, no amendment shall be made to the Constitution which will authorize or give to Congress the power to abolish or interfere within any state with the domestic institutions thereof, including that of persons held to labor or service by the laws of said state. Wow. GR.
Right. So basically, Lincoln was going to galvanize an amendment into the Constitution to allow slavery to be never to be removed.
What was he thinking?
Well, he didn't care. He didn't think the blacks could ever be equal.
Lincoln, nobody, I don't know that many people living today will agree with what you just said.
No, but if you read the Douglas debates, this is exactly what Lincoln said. If you read the Douglas debates, he talks about the inferiority of blacks, that they could never be equal to whites. He didn't think that they should be slaves necessarily, but they could never be equal. They should never be able to vote, and so forth and so on. So when actually he won the election, it was easy to become the turncoat and say, well, that was just, a debate in a state that I had with Douglas. It wasn't law, and I'm not making law. So, I want to actually promote this because he saw the states already talking about seceding. And he said, and the states, it was very clear that the states were going to secede over this slavery issue. So the one thing he did so that he wouldn't become the failure president is to offer them this beautiful, magnanimous 13th Amendment, 14th Amendment to, say, hey, please, you know, consider this proposed amendment so that you will never lose slavery and you won't feel that threat from me or my administration.
This actually might have been a proposed 14th Amendment, since there was...
Yeah. No, it was a 14th Amendment. Yeah, it was. Right.
Okay. Interesting. Okay, well, I just downloaded the Lincoln-Douglas debates because I didn't... This wasn't clear to me.
Okay. And actually, later on, I can provide you a citation of what page you can find where Lincoln actually comes right out and talks about, I think, blacks or Negroes or what have you, whatever the vernacular was at the time. And it wasn't a nice thing to say, but it's ironic that, you know, all black Americans today look at him as almost a demigod.
Sure.
Anyway, sure. So this literally failed. It was a shot that literally failed. And okay. So this amendment didn't even pass muster. As a matter of fact, states started leaving the union, and this was now it was this. and you know what's ironic? I think the reason the states actually shot or left is because they knew the northern states wouldn't have ratified it. It was just like it was a hollow letter.
Yeah.
Okay, so the next 13th or 14th Amendment actually passed. Yeah. It was proposed in 1865 and ratified in 1865. Now, this happens to be the year that Lincoln allowed a temporary assembly of Congress, because he actually violated the Constitution and basically excused them.
So, do you want me to read this?
Yes, go ahead.
We got a minute and a half, so...
Yep, go ahead.
Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for a crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. And can I read Section 2?
Yeah, go ahead.
Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation.
In other words, it's kind of like, Congress, as it's stated in the Constitution, Article 1... all legislative authority is vested in Congress. So, I mean, this is almost basically regurgitating.
Redundant.
Yeah, it's absolutely so. But I think this was a sleight of hand done by Congress to say, we're going to come up with a way of enforcing this without using the militia.
Mm.
But that was never discussed. That was never talked about. And so, but down the road, that's what they said, or that's what they're claiming, is that, we granted our ability to enforce this, but this has nothing to do with Article 1, Section 8. There's never been discussion that this is how they basically undid Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 14. Anyway, back into this, there's a lot that we want to get into, but let me just say this, that we're finding that people that are in the military service once you've signed up, you become, you know, obligated for that contract. Mm-hmm. However, that's only in the military. However, I have found and discovered that there are federal employees that is actually being applied to them too. In other words, they are under involuntary servitude because they can't just walk out or quit. And so that's an interesting discussion, but we'll bring this up when we move forward in the next time Paul is back, which will be next Monday. Folks, I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobius Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.